White Hot Magazine, one of the world's leading platforms and institutions for contemporary art. Find us online at whitehotmagazine.com and on social media platforms.
This is Lita Barry, and I'm a contributing writer for White Hot Magazine. And I'm here in my library with this week's guest, Lawrence Fuller, who is an actor and a multi-talented writer who combines poetry, art criticism, and screenwriting. And he's recently wrote an award-winning screenplay on his legendary father, Peter Fuller. What made you decide to write on your father?
Well, hi Lita, thank you for inviting me. This is the subject, this is how we met.
I know.
Sitting at a cafe in Larchmont,
right.
Writing the screenplay.
That's right. And you had an interesting pile of books, including Lawrence Fuller and I think John Berger.
That's right.
And I said, something like that's a very interesting pile of books you have, and this writer Peter Fuller was my inspiration for becoming an art critic. And you said,
I imagine I said, that's amazing, you know, no way. who are you? We must connect.
You said he was your father.
Oh, I said he was my father. Oh yes
of course, and I that almost fell off my chair.
Yeah.
And that was actually the beginning of a conversation which has gone on for several years.
Yep.
Which can go on forever.
I hope so.
And it's almost as if your father brought us together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What he left behind was really amazing, even if I didn't have him there. You know, all the sort of the mysteries that he's left that have led me to so many paths in life that I would never have found otherwise if I didn't decide to pick up his journals and his books and read them and follow them.
So he died in a plane crash with your brother when you were four, was it?
A car crash, yes.
So you wouldn't have very many memories of him, would you?
No, very few memories that have quite faded, and perhaps memories of memories of memories.
Yeah.
You know, one of him coming home from London, because he would go to London all the time, and we lived in Bath.
Okay.
So, coming home with his briefcase and others, like him walking out of his study, he had this really. It's study not unlike this one, honestly.
Oh really?
Yeah, I mean he was, you know, more haphazard, so he had like papers and everything all over the floor as well. Yours is much neater.
Well, mine is like that most of the time. It's just that when you visited, I put that away to try and look respectable.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that's just writers. We like lots of books and notes around us.
Yeah.
But you must too, right?
Yeah, oh my gosh. Don't remind me.
Your mother was also an artist, or is an artist, and she later married an Australian art critic whose writing I know.
Yeah.
So you were born into the art world, weren't you? You literally learned to walk in art galleries. You learned to talking to art critics and artists.
Yeah.
Or is that too extreme?
No, that's what I thought was normal life.
Ah.
And I didn't realize that wasn't normal life until probably mid-20s, mid-late 20s.
You didn't realize how rarefied that world was?
No, that was what people talked about, you know, that's what people cared about.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a long time of people not talking that way for me to understand that it was rare, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
For me to see the wait, there's something missing in these conversations, and to feel like an outsider of the rest of the world.
I can relate, because my mother was an artist and I grew up in artist studios that she would take me to. And she was a teacher, and artists would say, well, should we get her some toys? And she'd say, no, just give her an art book. And they'd say, well, who? And they said, well, she likes ballet, so give her Degas or something like that. And then they would start to ask me questions about the art, and I thought that was so cool that I could talk to adults. And that became, it became the normal thing for me to want to talk to artists and write about art. And it's shocking when you go outside that world, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it just feels like... what came to mind, actually, was in my father's memoirs, March Has Passed, he uses this metaphor the whole time of him feeling like an outsider, actually, to a certain clique in the art world. But he used the metaphor of being behind a pane of glass.
Oh.
And took it from this famous painting by David Hockney that he did of Casman, his dealer, where he's like up against the glass frame of the painting. And so often, actually, I think if you really look, or if you really think about a painting behind a pane of glass and the characters and the life behind it, it's like, it almost seems that that's what's separating us from this sort of paradise that is the painting, is the pane of glass in front of it.
Oh.
So the as my, you know, as I drift off into this metaphor, what my point was, feeling like behind a pane of glass, like, I guess so much of, so many things just feel like that outside of
the art world.
Outside of the art world, because in the art world you're talking about passions and you're talking about,
yes,
like these things that are really essentially human.
Yes, and there's always more to learn, and nobody ever feels that they're good enough. There's always some area where they could be better,
right?
I think. You know, sometimes, well, I always think of it as ideas, particularly aesthetic ideas, are like oxygen for me. And so if I'm around people who don't know about art or only know about it in a superficial way, I feel as if I'm suffocating and I can't breathe.
Yeah.
Not getting that oxygen.
Yeah.
So when you decided to write the screenplay on your father, it meant that you had to go write back into all his journals and notes.
Yeah, I went back into his journals and notes that I think I'd only really superficially understood when I was younger. Because, you know, there's so much sort of maps of the mind that you need to unlock before you can fully appreciate, like, that level of writing. It includes politics, it includes culture, of course, it includes art history. And it includes life itself. Like, it includes life experience that, you know, when you're younger, you don't have yet. But you can still enjoy it. And I think when you read, like, an essay by Berger or Peter Fuller or Kenneth Clark or any of the critics that they spoke about, or, you know, Ruskin, even though Ruskin does just dribble on a lot, but still,
I love Ruskin, but yes, yeah, okay, yeah. Many of those writers were poets too, or came out of literature.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't just journalism that your father wrote. It had more philosophy and a lot of psychology.
Yes.
Art and psychology, and it was the poetic way of writing, which you have, and I want to come back to that, but it's an art form in itself, really.
Oh, absolutely.
No question.
He loved the quote by Oscar Wilde.
He was a critic
that said that higher criticism is the record of one's soul.
Yeah.
So they really believed that. And his, Peter's degree was in philosophy.
My degrees were in philosophy. Yeah. I mean, I did do journalism, but later. I mean, it's funny because art historians are quite different. They trace influences. And I notice that many critics, either they come from philosophy or they come from literature and poetry, particularly.
Yeah, and Baudelaire is probably not remembered for his art criticism, but he was.
He was.
Yeah, he remembered more for Flowers of Evil, which is maybe my favourite poetry book.
Yes, Victor Hugo did, John Yale today. You can go on and on.
Yeah. Right.
Donald Cuthbert comes out of philosophy.
Right. And, I mean, you for instance, have a very, you know, well-established education instead of my father. and so did many of the people we're bringing up. My education in classical theatre, so I didn't have a lot of those references when approaching the writing, except for what I've picked up from my own intuition, which is probably also a lot of people that might be listening to this too.
Yes.
People who come to art from different, for different reasons.
Well, Jerry Saltz has no high school, college degree. I don't think Noah has either.
Right on. Yeah. And, but through art, it is that keyhole that starts unlocking and bring, and if you have the passion and the motivation to want to understand an essay by any of these guys, it can take you to those places and then you can find out for your, you know, for oneself what it is that they're talking about.
Yes, so it is, I mean, our criticism is subjective, obviously, but in a way, the more subjective it is in taking someone in on the critic's sort of journey through the work, the more powerful it is.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you cannot deny the political influence on, you know, Peter Fuller and Berger and their central conflict, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, when Berger wrote books like Permanent Red, you know, his... Marx's point of view is subtextual and also overt. And to learn about Marx through, I mean, both those very subjective writers is probably the best way to try to understand that such a heady philosophy, even if you don't agree
and
with
why,
any of
why
Marx.
Why it impacted them. Well, we were just talking about fairy tales and I was telling you that Oscar Wilde and Hans Christian Andersen, you know, those their fairy tales were based on socialism and Marxism.
Right.
And the human characters were horrible. And it was the animals and the plants that had the real soul, remember?
Yeah, and that William, that very William Morris sort of romanticized socialist perspective that was like, you know, I mean, William Morris had a wonderful view of utopia and News from Nowhere. And obviously William Morris came from being a craftsman, a designer. And yet his outlining of a utopian socialist society was beautiful. Like if only that could exist where everybody lived their life as artisans, creating things that were for the use of others, but were essentially beautiful. That were ornamental and they made things with their hands.
I totally relate to that. Well, Robert Hughes was quite a Marxist and he was politically very progressive. It's funny because he's often seen as being conservative and reactionary because he didn't like Andy Warhol.
Yeah, I thought he was
conservative. No, he wasn't. And actually he was close friends with Germaine Greer, with the feminist movement. He was involved in all of those things.
Yeah, yeah. Germaine Greer is definitely in there with, you know, as a peer of the, you know, my father and his circle.
Yes, well that was, mind you, we're talking Australia then, but then there were a lot of people were in that time were very involved in these ideas. So where is your screenplay now? It won an award, didn't it? Your screenplay on your father, Modern Art.
It won 8 awards on the screenplay circuit.
Eight
awards.
Impressive.
One, I was presented by Shane Black, whose claim to fame is he's the highest paid screenwriter of all time, but, you know, a legend in Hollywood. And so that's where it's up to. And then honestly, I kind of finished it and started submitting to these competitions in 2022. And then I started to sort of take off for my digital art stuff. Like, it became my whole world. And it's been in my top drawer ever since. Okay. I haven't even I mean, the film world has gone through such a tumultuous time. Haven't even approached, you know, haven't even thought of submitting it to
get Well, that was the lockdown too, the COVID lockdown, so.
It was during lockdown I was able to finish it and submit it. And then, you know, it's the film industry, so we're recovering from strike and all sorts of things. So.
Now, the last time we were talking, you said something that I haven't been able to get out of my mind because it fascinated me so much, that when you look at art, you like to imagine being inside the painting. And now I look at art like that, it's like, well, this is how Lawrence would do. Now, the digital work you're doing now, combining your interest in your love of art and of poetry, because you're also a very good poet.
Mm.
How did you come to that? Is that from imagining yourself inside paintings?
Yeah, I think it's really from the child in me that I see it that way. That, you know, seeing the paintings around me in the living room when I was a child, but also finding myself gravitating to cinema. You know, I ended up in the cinematic arts, and that came from wanting to be, you know, as these art critics were talking about, were writing from a subjective point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be, you know, the subject of the adventure.
Ah.
Maybe that's a narcissistic thing, but that's what I wanted. Really? I wanted to experience the story. I wanted to have the conversation. I wanted to be a part of the unfolding of that world. And I wanted to step inside the painting.
It makes me think of Alice in Wonderland, going into the Wonderland, or even maybe my ancestor, who wrote Peter Pan, maybe it's going into Wonderland too.
Wow.
It's going on a journey, isn't it?
It's going on a journey, and that the childlike sort of spirit, I suppose, that is so easily squashed by the world, the modern world, especially, that sort of puts us in these rigid definitions and straight lines, blinding skeleton and black square of the skyscraper, which is that phrase I borrowed from Ruskin.
Okay.
But, you know, modernity, I think, it really threatens the imagination and precious faculties of the soul.
Why?
I think because the ornamental in life, and in all things, and in architecture, and in all the things around us, have been superseded by function.
Mm-hmm.
So, the function of, you know, cars, or and the functionality of a cup or a plate or a table, has taken precedence over a feeling and sentiment. You know, inherent within the making. And
what about the aesthetics of, you know, form and function, when the beauty is about the function? Isn't that
right?
Was a core part of modernism.
Yeah, it's definitely an essential, the essential sort of birthplace of modernism, which I think is,
well, in Bauhaus particularly.
In Bauhaus, notwithstanding, that is. But Bauhaus came out of a time. Bauhaus came out of a time where those things that were ornamental, and those things that were imaginative, and those things that cherished sentiment, were being exploited, and were reaction against.
And they also wanted to make design affordable.
Yeah.
And so beautiful design from inexpensive materials, which would mean that people could have a much more aesthetic life, and that was available to more people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ironic that all those beautiful mid-century modern homes up in the Hollywood Hills now are only owned by the wealthiest movie directors or high-tech people.
It's a good point, but, you know, is the technology now not more capable, you know, of making affordable beauty?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it should always be affordable.
Mm.
Or better still, going along with the love of craft that you said took one person into art criticism, then more people hopefully can make their own. I think more people are repurposing and doing things. I mean, I do it. I take old cabinets and put new knobs on them and paint them with lacquer. I mean, haven't you done that?
I did that with a birdcage once. It turned this TV cabinet into a birdcage when I kept parrots.
Ah, that's right. You used to have cockatoos, didn't you?
I had cockatiels.
Cockatiels. Yeah,
good memory. I told you that tidbit once and you remembered.
I know. I think you sent me a photograph of it once.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
So what brought you to Los Angeles? And you came here 14 years ago?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was cast in a religious movie called Apostle Peter and the Last Supper.
Okay.
As the Saint Martinian in the story of the Apostle Peter. And mm-hmm. the Apostle Peter was played by Robert Loggia, who was, it was his last lead role in a film. Mm-hmm. He was 83 at the time, and he was, you know, was as full and magnificent as an actor, I think, as you could hope for. The only caveat was his, you know, short-term memory, so I had to hold up his lines in front of him on like a piece of board and like poke my head over the top to act in the scenes. But yeah, aside from that, it was a wonderful experience to act mm-hmm. opposite him.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with the place, the sunshine and the palm trees. A huge breath of fresh air from...
Now, you had lived between London or Bath and Sydney, is that correct? Up until then?
Yes, London, Bath, Sydney, and but also studied... lived in Canberra.
Oh, okay. Sure. But you studied acting in London, and then that brought you here.
I studied... So, yeah, I was born in Bath, and then we moved to London when I was 4, and then to Sydney when I was 7, and then to Canberra when I was 13. And then okay. I moved back to London when I was 18,
okay.
and then studied in Bristol, and then moved back to London to do some theatre, and then moved out here 14 years ago.
And like David Hockney, you fell in love with the palm trees.
I fell in love with the palm tree. Yeah, I don't know how David Hockney's been such a spectre in my life. It's so funny.
That's right, you played him, didn't you, in an HBO documentary recently?
I played him in it's a series called Minx, but it's a true, mm-hmm. It's sort of a bio series based on this magazine called Minx from the 70s. It was sort of okay. like the first Playgirl. Then David Hockney was a massive fan. He liked looking at the photography of the nude men and used them as references.
Oh.
So okay, he so carried around a, yeah. stacks of these magazines like used them as references for his paintings.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So now, after 14 years of being in Los Angeles, and this is balancing acting and writing, and you do write art criticism too, and we'd love to have you writing for White Hot magazine. I know that Noah keeps asking. But how do you find one, do they cross-feed each other? Is it a cross-fertilization, or is it difficult to go backwards and forwards?
I think they're essentially intertwined. Mm-hmm. And that I feel like they can't breathe without the other.
Oh, I like that.
You know, you read Stanislavski, who was the first sort of dramaturgist on method acting, and it's littered with art history references.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
And literary, and you know, and about romanticism and the cultural things were going on in the time, and you know, it was, and also there was politics mixed in there. There was all sorts of references.
We really wouldn't have cinema without art. I mean, you think of people like Kubrick, who took Rembrandt light, and who else? A lot of other things that have been taken out of looking at painting deeply. David Lynch went to art school, didn't he? And is also an artist.
And Ridley Scott went to art school.
Yeah.
And he draws all his own storyboards, paints them.
Yes.
Like their paintings.
Ah, like Hitchcock. He did storyboards, didn't he?
Yeah.
I often think it's a bit artificial to separate the arts. I mean, coming from New Zealand, in a small city, the painters knew poets, knew people in composing music, knew choreography, and it was such a tiny place and there wasn't much to do that we'd all meet in one coffee shop and be there until all hours of the night. We all went to the Foreign Film Society. And it was very common for, say, a painter to use lines from poetry as the title for their paintings and have the painter do the cover of their poetry book. And for painters to ask poets to title their works. It was just a very natural thing.
Yeah, and I think the Pre-Raphaelites were really inspired by John Keats and vice versa.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And I found writing poetry in my own process as a method actor too, art was essential in that, in visual references to draw from when I was sort of preparing a role.
Mm-hmm.
So I recently did two collaborations with opera singers. One who's passed away, Maria Callas, and worked with her estate.
Wow.
To do a digital art collaboration on some unpublished restored tracks of hers from Medea. And the other, Vittorio Grigolo, from
mm-hmm.
one of his seminal performances of Una Fativa Lagrima.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking into a little bit of the history of opera, and the word came from opus, which means just a body of work, like a piece of work. And what it encompassed was Monteverdi, at the time when he created the medium, and he said the way to really reach an audience was to unite poetry and music. And opera was essentially this fusion of these pre-existing art forms.
Yeah.
Of poetry, of music, set design, performance, storytelling, literature. All of these things sort of working in symbiosis for.
And in contemporary opera, I'm thinking of Philip Glass. I went to see his last work a couple of years ago. Even more so, set design, and I think hasn't David Hockney designed sets?
Magic Flute.
That's right.
Mozart's Magic Flute.
That artist Gronk in Los Angeles, in downtown Los Angeles, he does a lot of theatre design. Yes, that's just natural, isn't it? Didn't Chagall, a long time ago, somebody important.
There's, at the New York Symphony, what's that place? Right next to Juilliard, New York Symphony, is it the Opera House? New York Symphony?
The Link, no.
They're building anyway, there's massive, mm-hmm. two massive Chagall mm-hmm. paintings.
It was Chagall who did costume design, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's always been collaboration with choreographers and dance. But going back, you said the aesthetic of modernism didn't appeal to you as much as more ornate work.
I mean, this is a line that I'm sort of stealing from my late father, yeah. But I think I was brought up as a romantic and the tenets of romanticism have really been instilled in me since I was very young.
Yeah.
And I really can't shake them.
Yes, and you like figurative work. I mean, whenever I hear you talking about exhibitions and artists you like, it's always figurative.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
I love figurative and figures in landscape. There's, yeah, I definitely
Your
love
father landscape. Loved landscape.
Yeah.
But you love figurative.
Yeah, I mean, Peter, he loved, he championed the London School as well. He loved figurative too, but yeah, ideologically, he thought landscape was of the highest order, aesthetic.
Well, there were such important landscape painters in the 80s that he wrote about,
yeah.
And he started Modern Painters magazine, so he really championed that against the avant-garde.
Yeah.
And I liked your father's idea that there wasn't a shared mythology, but that could be based around the landscape, and certainly the English way of looking at nature, and I share it a lot, well, growing up in New Zealand, but you know, I'm from Scottish background, there it isn't, We see it as alive, and there's a devotional quality to nature, to looking at nature, to enjoying being in nature. I mean, growing up in New Zealand, we lived in nature. We didn't look at nature. We lived inside it. I think that's very different from an American sensibility. And, well, no, maybe the cowboys and you're watching Yellowstone and they have that idea there.
The American landscape is sweeping and epic, and it has the potential to really be essential to American life.
It does.
But it does feel like in the modern America, we are encapsulated in these bubbles of our cars that we go from one little bubble to another.
And
are sort of behind the pane of glass, completely separate from nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Peter was also really inspired by Australia.
So he went backwards and forwards even. Okay.
He did. And my mother's Australian.
Yes.
So painters like Arthur Boyd and...
Australian landscape painting is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Australian landscape, I think, was even more influential, or just as influential as the British landscape on his thinking.
I was just thinking back in New Zealand, there was a big debate between what they called the nationalists and the internationalists. Mm-hmm. And the idea, and I know they did this in Australia too, of developing a unique style which really went with the landscape and the qualities of the landscape, which wasn't drawing from international art, i.e. copying what was going on in America or Europe.
Yeah.
And in New Zealand, it was the quality of light, the darkness. It's very dark. So now I'm thinking that probably Peter Fuller was thinking about that too, that the quality of the landscape that you grow up in does shape our vision, doesn't it? You know that saying I get a lot, you can take the woman out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the woman, or they say it about men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our essential yearning or our instinctual need to create a garden wherever we go.
Yes. Yes.
That is a sentimental, instinctual need that we have. No one really needs a garden.
No, but that's right. But we do need to create in our own garden.
Yeah.
Yes.
Gardens are actually essential for life.
Yes, I wonder what that is. It becomes like a church in a way, doesn't it? Or it's a place of solace.
Yeah, and communion.
And working with nature is so healthy, to be able to plant things and see them grow and to actually be able to eat them or eat their fruit is just very fulfilling. Yeah.
Yeah, even... I think it's no mistake that the fable of Adam and Eve, the story of Adam and Eve, is that they're in a garden.
They were born in a garden, yeah.
Born in a garden.
Yeah.
That was actually protected and cult, and God was the gardener of, the cultivator of that garden. And it was sectioned off from the outside.
Well, in England after the First World War, didn't they promise all the soldiers that they would have a small lot which they could garden? And there's a very famous poem written by an unknown soldier who died. If I should die, think only this of me, that there is some piece of land in a far-off place that is forever mine. It was like it was a longing that the soldiers had. They were in the mud, in the trenches, that they could go back and have this garden, even if it was... they had to walk miles to it, where they could grow their own sweet pea and tomatoes.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So going forward, in the 14 years that you've lived here, of course, the Los Angeles art world, the city itself, but the art world has changed tremendously, hasn't it? Is that still going? Thanks. It's changed tremendously.
Oh, you got a phone call, but is it still recording? They can edit this out if it's
yes, he can edit.
Is it? Yeah, it's
okay.
Recording.
So we're going. Go back. In the 14 years that you've been here, you've seen tremendous changes in the art world, and I'd be interested in your response to those. Jerry Saltz has said that in the 24 years since the 21st century, art has changed thousands of times more than the 20 centuries of art that we had before the year 2000. What I'm seeing is it's more around 2015 that things really, really started to change. What is your reaction, or what are your thoughts on that?
I think that my thoughts on it are that there is a thriving art world, in a contemporary art world in Los Angeles, that has been cultivated by the communities here. That I mean, when I first came, and I still really gravitate to a gallery like LA Louvre,
mm-hmm.
and the painters that they have there, and one shared favorite of art,
mm-hmm.
Enrique Martinez Celaya, who okay.
He is
now at Michael Cohen, right?
Actually, he was at Michael Cohen. Now he's at United UTA.
Right.
United Talent Agency.
No way.
Yes, I know. It's a surprise, isn't it?
But
okay, you first saw him there. And yes, we both admire him.
First saw him there. Obviously, that's where David Hockney and some London School painters are represented. Their estates are represented. That's
right. And he always did show a lot of London painters. Well, he's Peter Gould's.
Peter Gould.
Is British.
It's British. And
London, English.
Has done a wonderful job of representing those aesthetics and also finding similar aesthetics in the contemporary Los Angelian scene, but you know, not religiously. But
that's interesting. You think Peter Gould has taken that eye? Yes, I can see. And Elizabeth
East.
Yes, she's a director there in English.
Yeah, she.
So you found your right place, right? Like a homing pigeon.
Yeah, I did. That was the first gallery I really connected with when I got out here, and was even talking to them about working there at one point, but we realized it has to be all or nothing. Like, I mm-hmm. would have had to go up my film career, and I okay. wasn't willing to do it. So so what I saw then compared to what I see now, I think is, and however these things change, and however, like, whatever is trendy is changing, I think there's always going to be this essential battle between art that is heavily politicized or ideological, and that which is sort of more what we've been talking throughout this discussion, feeling for, and has universal truth to it,
mm-hmm.
and that the dedication to discovering and expressing those truths is something that's never ending, and also its opposition of expressing what is current today and, you know, timely today,
mm-hmm.
And perhaps there's something essential between the two that is expressive of universal truths today. And what sort of came about, I think, when lockdown happened, there was a huge boom in the art world, and also in digital art.
Mm-hmm.
The game for digital art completely changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Noah, who runs mm-hmm. White Hot Magazine, is also part of that scene. And,
mm-hmm.
Because this thing called NFTs came about,
mm-hmm.
which is a dirty word in many circles in the art world, but I don't know if it's making its way, you know. The more people that get sort of onboarded, and the more people that sort of take it seriously, more galleries like Pace, that mm-hmm. has a whole Web3 division,
mm-hmm.
And Pace is a great, one of the top galleries in LA and around the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's one of the big ones, yeah.
Yeah, so the more it's embraced by those cultural institutions, then... and Musée d'Orsay has a whole Web3 program now.
Ah, so what's going on there?
Yeah, and MoMA just acquired Rafik Anadol's.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what it's called, the big installation. So I think, and that came about in 2021, and has sort of, you know, had its sort of market peaks and troughs, but actually culturally has been just been steadily growing.
Yeah, interesting. Well, art's always tied with using new technologies, and you can't separate it from money. And I'd kind of like to bring up something else, which I mentioned to you earlier. There's a huge amount of money being poured into the art world now, and there's a huge amount of money that can be made from the art world.
Right.
And of course, there are opportunists who come in for the wrong reason, that people who would have been hedge funders are now investing in young artists to promote them, etc. But I actually think it's great. I love it that so much money has been poured into the art world, because we see things like my last review was of Luna Luna, which was the wonderful art amusement park that was at the Hamburg in 1987, and it was lost. And it was Drake, a hip hop artist, who poured 100 million into resuscitating it, restoring it, otherwise it would be forgotten. And I think it's great to see this happening now. A lot of people with way too much money are spending it in art, and the galleries now are really going after influencers to bring in more people with money. Because even if you look historically, the great periods of art, the great renaissances, have always been when economies became really affluent and you had a much bigger upper middle class.
Hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the more the walls between the arts and the sectors, technology and the arts, the walls between those sectors are breaking down, the better. And I think that there's a beautiful connection between art and technology that is just, and that wall is just starting to be broken. Silicon Valley, where a huge amount of the world's capital has gone, because that's how our world is changing, is now seeing, now that they've built the infrastructure, they understand that they need artists to captivate the people.
Yes, and to do the web designs and the aesthetics behind the technology.
Yeah,
to which in a way Steve Jobs always understood that. I mean, Apple computers are like art pieces.
Yeah, he didn't.
Even more than a Bauhaus, isn't it? I mean, I love Apple. Look at this room. How much Apple technology do I have? It's beautiful.
Yeah, and Steve Jobs was the artist of Apple. He was not the technologist. You're right.
Yes.
There was another guy who was the technologist.
Well, they're like pieces of jewelry, your laptop and your iPhone. Why not enjoy them? But that's pure Bauhaus.
Yeah, to build
form and function.
Well, I mean, yeah, but couldn't you also say that Steve Wozniak was the Bauhaus designer,
mm-hmm.
and Steve Jobs was the romanticist who filled in some of the colours.
He was a romanticist, I agree. Yeah. But back to this money that's been, what we're seeing now is that art is being shown on a scale in Los Angeles that was inconceivable before. I would never have thought of Freeze when it was shown. I loved it at Paramount, now it's at the Hangar. But just that scale.
Mm.
Or that a hip-hop artist would throw $100 million into restoring a art amusement park, which was in shipping containers on the side of a road in the prairie in Texas, for God's sake.
Amazing.
Amazing. So it can, like, you know, art, money is not a bad thing. It can be used for good purposes. It's the way it's used. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's great to bring more money into the art world.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've been fully enveloped in Web3 world, which has been tied to the digital currency markets. And it's interesting you talk about the hip-hop,
mm-hmm.
the hip-hop stars being a great patron.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of speculation on the identity of one of the biggest collectors in digital art called Cosimo Medici,
mm-hmm.
who everyone thinks it's Snoop Dogg.
Oh!
Yeah. Whose collection he spent about $17 million on digital
art. Oh, I love that. And I can, yes, I love that.
Yeah. And his has actually donated a huge portion of his collection to LACMA. So LACMA's digital art collection is mostly made up of what is speculated to be Snoop Dogg's acquisitions.
Oh, I love that. Well, Kehinde Wiley, I mean, he's making a fortune from his paintings, but he's giving so much back. He gives so much back. And in a way, it's no different from great actors who give a lot back. Creative people tend to be very generous. They're not hoarders.
Right.
They like, you know, if they make money doing what they love.
Yeah.
They're doing it because they love it. And so they give it back and they're generous.
Yeah. There's been two movie stars that I've been working with creating these digital art collaborations. And with some of them with painters like Tanya Revillis, or special effects artists like Ruben Froh.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Val Kilmer and my business partner, Vincent D'Onofrio.
Okay.
And so we've worked with Heinrich Kildallen and Ruben Froh on collaborations and, you know, given them like some, a new platform that they may have not otherwise had. And they've also shared that platform with us. And also Vincent has, you know, he's started his collection more recently, but he has acquired a number of pieces. Obviously his collection of mine, which is much appreciated. But
your pieces are for sale, but as in NFTs?
Yes, just as NFTs right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at like what they would be in physical form, but they would still be attached to an NFT. Mm-hmm. Like, because we're creating a custom frame for them for people's houses.
Okay.
That is completely unique and would be displayed, you know, in a custom way, but it would be attached to the NFT.
But it's also the beautiful poetry that you write for them that makes them stand out. That's what makes them different.
Yeah, I mean, what I just described is just how it would look in a collector's home, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. The unique, the specialness is mm-hmm. the poetry and yeah. the cinematic qualities and the aesthetics and
mm-hmm.
it is a piece of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But it lives like in like a moving painting or a portrait.
Well, poetry moved over into the world of pop music, didn't it? I mean, I love to sit with a book of poetry and look how many books of poetry are sitting around us today.
Yeah.
But it was really when people like Joni Mitchell, you know, could sing poetry, or Leonard Cohen could sing poetry, that it reached more people.
Yeah.
Too. It wasn't just something that you would go to a poetry reading and a little kind of hole in the wall bookstore. It suddenly reached a mass audience.
Yeah, no, I mean, Leonard Cohen was a poet first and then became a musician when he was in his 40s. But I think about that sometimes, how, oh yeah, well, music is the evolution of poetry.
Evolution of it. Going back to Cole Porter, probably.
Yeah.
It was probably the beginning of it.
And I mean, I've definitely gone back to an earlier time and then sort of gone down a different road because my pieces are like, they contain music, but you wouldn't categorize them as music.
No, but the idea of bringing poetry into visual form, which is inspired by painting, to me is very like bringing poetry into pop music.
It's like we've gone back 100 years and then and then like deconstructed it a bit and then brought some of these other very old fashioned sort of ideas and mediums and then brought them together in a different way.
Well, that's what art always does. That it's kind of constant revision and back and sort of retrieving things and giving them a new life and a new form, isn't it? It's never totally brand new.
No.
It's always sort of allegorical in that sense. But the idea of building walls and separating things is kind of goes against the artistic impulse, doesn't it? The creative impulse.
Yeah, I mean, we need definitions in order to break them. And I think that's something that they kept telling us at drama school for when it came to theatre. It's like, okay, you're this expressive being and you want to perform, but we're going to teach you rules. We're going to teach you rules so that you can, later on, you can break them.
Exactly. You need to learn the rules before you can break them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to find out what definitions are in order to redefine.
We end it. Is there something you want?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like I could talk to you forever.
I know. We could talk forever.
You know, and what an amazing location here in your study. It's just full.
Oh, it's nice having you here. I mean, it's going to. You always give me so much to think about and bring so much joy into my life. So it's kind of an excuse to bring people into my library, and but it's a nice place to do a podcast, right?
Oh yeah, it sort of inspires, like, you know, I guess it feels like you could go anywhere with ideas when you step into somewhere like this. It's like like you're sort of bouncing from shelf to shelf.
Yes, on the books.
On the books.
Yeah, and it's eclectic, and New Zealand art, Australian art, as well as American. My mother's books.
Are those magazines as well?
Those are really old art forums and art news from the early 70s that were given to me by the editor of a magazine I wrote for called Art Space, and they had to move, and they said, would you like this collection of magazines and can you look after them? And at some point I need to give them to a school to be catalogued. So I've had them for 25 years, so I've been looking after them. Yeah.
Well, it's important that somebody does that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Some things, like, we don't know how special it is at the time.
I know, and you can see I don't throw books away. I don't throw many things away, actually.
Mm.
And I'm always buying them. What do they say? You don't buy a book because you need to read it now. You buy it because you might need to read it someday. But I love just going up and pulling books. And, you know, if I get stuck writing, I think, I've got to read some lines from Virginia Woolf because she really brings you in. And even like Dickens, I think, is amazing the way he writes in the present tense, and he just paint the beginning of A Tale of Two Cities. You just feel as if you're there. I mean, I think a lot of those great novelists were painted with words, or they made movies with words. They're so visual, and I love that way words can conjure up visual things. Sometimes I struggle with it in my own work, so that's why I need to dip into other people. But it's not like I dip into other art critics. I prefer to dip into Dickens or Virginia Woolf. Or, yeah, people like that. Lorca, I like. Yeah. I think we've ended.
Yeah. I still, in my poetry, I still am trying to get to a place where I can match the first chapter of Cormac McCarthy's Sutri. American writer, but
yeah,
he was someone very connected to the land as well. But the way he described this disgusting lake where this homeless man lived was like gorgeous. Like,
he's just talking about with you.
Dead catfish on the side of the banks in this way that's so like textured, and the language he used was so onomatopoeic of the.
Yeah.
Of the sounds of the lake and the decaying fish. And I mean, you know, there was so much beauty in the ugliness that he saw in that riverbank. And I just listened to that chapter, just the first chapter. Like, I don't think I finished the book yet, but I just listened to the first chapter just to like, remember how you can set a scene. And like, like you say. Like,
and so that's your touch point and you keep coming back to it.
Actually, yes. And it's
I think it's really important to remember what the first inspiration was for you to do what you end up doing. and to keep coming back to it. And of course, the great thing is it's never fully attainable. We never really fully, can never ever be really satisfied with our work, right?
No.
Mm. I think that's a good place to end, with it isn't an ending.
Keep trying to end it.
I know, keep trying to end it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going, okay, and this is going to be the real end.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, wouldn't it be awful if that didn't come through?